While the panel is getting seated, can we ask some of the people to move down a little bit? It looks like you're all spread out. Maybe you want it that way, but if you can, it would be good to move down. Okay, my name is Bernie Weiss, and I'm a consultant to WINS, and I'm going to act as the moderator to this forum today. The first thing I would note is that we're very pleased with the turnout, which says something about the interest in security here, which is part of the reason that we came to IRPA this year. A great deal of attention has been paid to the security of nuclear material and the large nuclear facilities, mostly because of their high consequences. But less has been paid to the attention of the high-activity radioactive sources, although they're of low, maybe of low consequence compared to the big facilities. There are many more in number, and they are quite vulnerable. We in WINS are trying to promote nuclear security, and one of the ways that we think is useful is through professional associations. And because of that, we came to IRPA about a year ago, time talking to Ken Case and Ted Lazo, and they agreed that maybe it was timely to consider security at an IRPA conference, and they suggested that maybe a good thing to do would be to have a forum as the first introduction. So we thought the forum would be the only thing, but what we've seen is there are other papers being given on security. We've seen posters. There seems to be an interest. And as our first introduction, we thought we'd go really back to basics and look at the question of the role of radiation protection professionals in the security of radioactive sources. No longer, I think, in this particular area, we're just looking at a separation of security and safety, radiation protection. Things are becoming integrated, particularly here. And so we wanted to talk about how that can be done. This forum today, and forum means that we're looking for the input of the people out there, and we're going to try and structure this so we do get some input from you as well as our speakers. The forum will be structured to try and obtain those opinions. We're going to have a number of presentations. First, we're going to hear a little bit about WINS. Since we're here for the first time, we thought it would be useful to tell you what WINS is and what we're trying to do. We're going to have the opinion of an RSO, the aspect of education, where professional societies fit in, and where a little bit about international efforts in this area. And then, as time allows, we'll open this to more discussion. It's me. Anyway, our first speaker today is Pierre Legault from WINS. Pierre is the head of operational programs, and he's going to talk a little bit about WINS. Pierre?
Thank you, Bernie. Good afternoon, everybody. So very briefly, before we give the floor to the four panelists, I would like just to provide you with a brief overview of WINS, what we have achieved in the last 3 years, and in particular, what we do and what we would like to do in the field of radioactive sources. WINS is a very small organization. We are based in Vienna. We have 7 permanent staff. We are an NGO type. And our mission basically is simply to offer a forum of exchange for nuclear security practitioners. We are trying to gather in the same room people who are implementing security measures at nuclear facilities and for radioactive sources. We have been established 3 years ago. Basically, we have been launched during the IAGC 2008, but we started our operational program around May 2009. So as of today, we have completed our first cycle of operation, 3 years of operation that we call basically the foundation cycle. During this time, we have tried to establish the brand. We have tried to communicate to different stakeholders and demonstrate the added value of WINS in the nuclear security community. We have basically worked in 2 axes. One in the term of providing documents, the so-called international best practice guides. We have developed 25 of them, and we are trying to cover any kind of nuclear security related subject matters. In parallel to gather good practices, we are organizing workshops, and we have roughly done 30 workshops in the last 3 years. Something very important, this is the languages we are trying to use when we do our activities. As of today, we do it in English. Many people at the international level, they do speak English, but we are trying to engage field practitioners, people at the lower level in the nuclear organization or in the different hospitals or research institutions. So it's essential that we expand the field of activities to other languages. And we will continue to invest resources, time in this kind of efforts. We believe it's an essential criteria for success. When we talk about sources, among the 25 guides we have published, 2 of them are dedicated for radioactive sources. We have a kind of overarching document dealing with the security of high activity sources, and one dedicated to a special practice, which is well logging. We have also organized around this subject matter 7 workshops. We did it in Europe, in the UAE, in Southeast Asia. We have also tried to engage discussion with device manufacturers, with people producing irradiators, because too often people believe that the shielding was a very good barrier against theft and any other malicious act. But basically, when you do some studies, you clearly understand that these devices are very weak, very vulnerable to removal of the source, to theft. So we are in a cooperation project with the US to try to transfer kind of technology knowledge to device manufacturers to improve their security by design. Talking about our guides, they are very, very short documents. They are 25 to 30 pages. They are not consensus documents. It's just one way to put on the table a vision of nuclear security for a given topic matter. We can cover any subject matter. We have covered corporate governance, guard force management, performance metrics, sources. We are just trying to raise awareness in the organization and help them to self-assess where they stand in this subject matter. You will not find any detailed guidance on how to secure your sources or your materials, sorry, in the document. We are trying to engage managers and to offer processes. We are trying to give them a tool, a method to follow to develop good security programs. And then by engaging different practitioners, different stakeholders, we can help them to perform a kind of self-assessment, and we provide a kind of maturity scale, and then they can self-evaluate where they stand regarding international standards. Our workshops, basically, they are open to everybody. This is an opportunity to exchange on experiences and lessons learned. We try to discuss how good security system integrate people, equipment, procedures. It's comprehensive systems. We have a certain number of topical discussions. We are trying to discuss on the credibility of the threat. Is there anybody outside trying to steal your sources? What will be the consequences for the society, but also for your own organization of a malicious act involving your sources? We are trying to educate a bit the people on what means physical protection in terms of detection, delay, response. But we are not educating the people. We are just raising awareness, and we are trying to tell them what could be the impact on their operations of security measures. We are trying to benefit from experience and lessons learned from people who have already implemented security measures. We are trying to transfer this knowledge to people who will have to implement the security at a later stage. We will discuss it today, and Chris will do that. There is a clear focus on radiation protection professionals. There is a need to be sure that these people receive proper education and training in the field of security. So we have, for nuclear security purpose, a kind of academy to deal with education, training, professional development. We are also trying to address the component for security for RPPs and RSOs. So basically, this is what I wanted to tell you, if the slide will move, but does not move anymore. But you have on your chairs, for those who have the little leaflet, we would like to discuss different subjects through the four speakers. We would like to discuss what is the role of radiation protection professionals in security, as it was mentioned by Bernie. How can we cooperate with professional societies to disseminate the information, to engage as many people as possible in the world? So again, thank you very much for coming today, and I would like to give the floor to the first panelist.
Our first speaker is Carolyn Leon. She's been at the University of, at the University Medical Center at Utrecht for 20 years. And when she has said that when she finally had some responsibility for security, she finally realized that not all people have good intentions, and that she was really naive thinking that these things won't happen. Carla?
I was. Well, good afternoon. As Bernie said, I am a radiation protection professional for over 20 years now. And a few years ago, we ran a project in our hospital for enhancing security of CBRN materials. And as the project progressed, I realized that security is, well, as important as safety, and that we tend to think that if you take all kinds of safety measures, you get security in as well, but it's not the case. In this presentation, I'll give a short summary of this project, and we'll be passing the points on the slide. University Medical Center in Utrecht is a top clinical center. It is a teaching hospital for adults and children. And every year we admit more than 30,000 patients, and over 130,000 patients make a first visit to our to the hospital. We teach more than 3,000 students medicine and life sciences. And to keep everything running smoothly, we have more than 11,000 employees, ranging from low-skilled workers to academics. The hospital complex, as you can see in the picture, consists of four main buildings, and we have several outbuildings. We have 10 main entrances, which offer free entrance throughout the day. And the hospital is a very open character. Everyone who wants to enter can do so at their own choice. On a daily basis, we have more than 20,000 persons entering the premises, either as a patient, a visitor, or a third-party worker. We have our own security department at the hospital, and every year they receive more than 200 notifications of theft or loss of goods. Mostly they are of mobile phones and money or laptops and things like that. But among the stolen goods are also building materials, food, and all kinds of other items that can be taken away easily. We assume that only 30% of all thefts are reported, So it means that 600 or 700 thefts take place in a year, which means that twice a day something gets stolen. I was very shocked by that figure because I think that's very much. But the security people have told me that's rather normal. We have our own security guards and they check in the evening rounds whether offices and departments are closed off properly. Every year they find almost 7,000 doors that don't meet the standard, that are left open or are not locked properly. They give opportunity in that way. We have a system to deny people who don't behave as we want them to be, that they can be expelled, they can be denied access. On average, we do that to 30 persons in a year. And that means they've either been aggressive, violent, or have a case of proven theft. The security project I mentioned earlier was carried out to enhance the security of CBRN material. So it's not just the radiological sources or the radioactive sources, but it combined chemical and biological materials also. The project granted funds to finance improvements in the security, and we had to run the project in a given structure. We made an analysis of the current security status, and we ran through the process of identifying sources to be protected, processes in which there was a risk of theft or loss, and what kind of security elements we already have in place. We then identified vulnerable spots, and that makes you quite easily can identify any improvements. The project members were CBRN professionals and security professionals. We based the risk categorization of the sources in three levels, low, intermediate, and high. The risk classification differed slightly from the EIR classification on security of sources. The risk levels took into account the amount of damage to public health and the environment when a source was used maliciously. And in our hospital, most radioactive material ended up in the low-risk category. That only the blood irradiators and some kind of therapeutic radiopharmaceuticals ended up in the intermediate risk category. During the process of identifying critical processes, we spoke to radiation protection experts in the hospital, laboratory personnel, security officers, physicists, medics, paramedics, logistic experts, and it became apparent that we all had our own view on the need of security measures. Why is security needed anyway? There's nothing going wrong here. If we talked about the security measures that maybe had to be implemented, everybody was afraid that the impact of the new security manager would influence day-to-day business. And, well, people weren't too glad about that too. Well, in short, the conclusion was that there was little need for improvement, and if there was any, somebody else should implement the measures, not the people you spoke to, but it's always somebody else who has to do something. In the project, however, we concluded that the local storage and the receiving of goods were highly critical processes, whereas the purchase of radioactive sources, we considered it an intermediate critical process. Then we started talking about threats, and again, opinions differed. The possibility of theft of radioactive materials, well, there's almost nobody, well, except for the security people, who can imagine that somebody will take our radioactive materials to use maliciously. It's just inconceivable that something like that happen. The same thought applied for theft of knowledge. We asked people, do you think that the knowledge you have about the use of radioactive materials or where they are stored in the hospital, do you think that's of any interest to somebody with a malicious intent? Well, I think I spoke to one or two persons who said, well, maybe, but most of them said that it was inconceivable. We went a bit further and we asked them about how do you think about blackmail? Well, the thought of being blackmailed or being extorted for giving information, well, it didn't go well either. In the past 10 years, security in our hospital went through quite some changes. We no longer, this is our old hospital we had in the city until the 1980s. As you can see, there's just a gate around, and you, when you entered, you had to go through security. And in that days, you weren't allowed to enter any premises where no patients were. We don't longer have the gates, so we have all kinds of other measures. People working in a hospital have to hand in a certificate of good conduct. And although this gives minor guarantee on the trustworthiness of the employee, it proves to be a deterrent for applicants. We had a small number of cases in the last 5 years where applicants were rejected for not handing in a certificate of good conduct. Further, every employee has a personal card for identification and admittance to general areas like the parking lot, but also for specific areas like storage rooms, the operating theater, etc. Well, as you can see, we have our own central guards room with closed camera, TV circuits, and people monitoring the images on the CCTV. Well, from all the information we gathered in the project, we concluded that our vulnerability was most prominent in a number of areas. Not only was the awareness of possible threats and security measures low, where workers don't acknowledge the threats and therefore compliance to local rules is not as we would like it to be. On inspection rounds, we often find that doors are kept open that should really be closed. As you can see, this is the entrance room to our nuclear medicine production department. We tend to see that people use emergency exit just because it's a shorter route. And quite a lot of our personnel just ask if you're willing to enter a restricted zone, whether or not you're authorized to enter. Furthermore, we realized that several locations lacked security measures, like cameras or card readers. And we also concluded that there was a need for our security guards to have a basic understanding of radioactive sources, where on the premises radioactive sources are kept, and the significance of a quick and adequate response by the security guards when there were breaches in security. Before introducing these specific security measurements, we decided to start with the weakest link and enhance overall security. We introduced a new ID card with enhanced security technology, and in the future it will be possible to give authorizations on an individual basis. We placed door magnets on our back doors so we can act when somebody leaves through the exits. And we had to instruct our security guards that they do act when those alarms go off. On some specific locations near transport route, we placed extra cameras, and as a test, we placed the biometric access control on one of our storage rooms. Furthermore, we anchored some mobile sources to the wall, where we had to keep an eye on patient hospitalities in the brachytherapy units, because If you're in for radiation treatment and you see that the therapy unit is locked to the wall with chains, it doesn't feel good for the patient. With the security manager, we tracked and made revisions in the radiation protection guidebook and all procedures with aspects of registration and authorization of uses of radioactive materials were checked. And even now, we are still upgrading guidelines for the purchase and delivery of radioactive materials. We are discussing the possibilities of screening personnel in key positions. For instance, the employees in my radiation protection department have an overall knowledge of all radioactive sources in use in the hospital and ways to use them. They possess keys to storage rooms and know almost all relevant workers in the different departments. I believe they are trustworthy, but what if them is in a position vulnerable for blackmail? And finally, we have introduced a dedicated training module for our security guards and our in-hospital fire safety department. And we try to incorporate security in all presentations we give so that there is a basic awareness of rules and guidelines regarding security. We're not there yet, though. Keeping awareness of threats and risk at a sufficient level with all involved takes a lot of effort. You have to keep explaining that not everyone is of a friendly nature, and compliance to security measurements has to be monitored, and actions to enhance compliance have to be taken. In the future, we plan to contact our local police and discuss with them the possible risk and threats in our hospital. And as a final point, we try to make a security plan for the hospital and the premises. And hopefully that'll give us future reverence and better security awareness. I thank you.
Are there any questions for Carolyn?
Sorry. Can you say a bit more about your certificate of good conduct and what that is exactly and how effective you think it is as a measure against the insider threat? Is it only applied at the point of application for a post, or do staff have to renew it, and can they just invent it?
No, they can't invent it. It has a legal status in the Netherlands. Okay. But it only states whether or not you've been involved with the police or you have prior things you shouldn't have done. There's no follow-up. You only have to give in a certificate of good conduct when you're starting to work with us. And when we introduced it, there was no... they decided not to have the working personnel to hand in the certificate. So, there is a renewal of personnel for about 10% per year, but not everybody has... I didn't hand in a certificate of good conduct.
Back there.
Oh, hello. I'm Sue Chadwick from Guy's and Thomas's in London. I was just going to ask you whether you had support from the perhaps counter-terrorism branch of your police service. We have in the UK support from the Metropolitan Police Counter-Terrorism Security Advisors, and when we plan facilities, for instance with a blood irradiator as an example, you have to do those plans and procedures and physical security measures in cooperation and advice from that counter-terrorism security officer. You're saying that in the future you will consult your local police, but it did strike me as to what standards of physical security you're working to. For instance, as an example, for instance, what are your standards in relation to, for instance, door sets and alarm systems? How have you been supported and guided?
Well, there's no guidance from our police. The project I told about is funded by the counterterrorism group, the NCTB in the Netherlands. But we noticed in the project that their way of describing threats and making vulnerabilities known to the hospitals who were in the project, well, it didn't fit in with the way we look at the world, so there's quite a big gap. There is legislation coming in the Netherlands for the security of sources, but that will only be for the high-risk sources.
Okay. Joseph.
My name is Sabol, Czech Technical University in Prague. I just wonder whether you are also responsible for other dangerous materials, because your medical center is very big, and I'm sure you have many other dangerous materials like chemical, toxic materials, drugs, even biological materials. So I just wonder whether you apply similar system, or somebody else is responsible for other materials which also have to be kept secured.
Yeah, I'm only responsible for the radioactive materials, but in the project we work together with the people responsible for chemicals and the biological agents. Pharmaceuticals is within the medical part of the hospital, and that they tend to go their own route. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. If I could have the next. You've had a chance to ask a question. Now we want to ask you a question. This is our own interest. I don't know whether anybody wants to answer this, but those people out there, particularly those that are acting as an RSO or a radiation protection professional of some sort, do you consider security of radioactive sources to be a part of the role of radiation protection professionals? And if you do, do you get appropriate education and training to perform what you're expected to do? Can anybody willing to take an answer to that? There's somebody in the back.
No, it's okay.
Oh, wrong one. Okay, that's it.
Yes, and second question, do you believe? No, yes and no. Actually, I think for the smaller companies, we can't have four experts: expert on quality, expert on safety, expert on radiation, expert on security. So they try to combine things. I myself are responsible for transport, for safety, for environment. So my boss says, okay, you also be responsible for security. But I don't have any expertise on that field.
And what he gives you that responsibility, and does he also give you training?
Yes, of course. Of course, it's needed. Otherwise, you can't. And actually, what Caroline said, I experienced also. If you talk to security people, they have a different mindset. We have, as safety people, we always think what people will do good. We don't think as people as criminals. We think of people as who are willing to change, but security people always have glasses on what people do wrong. So that's a different way of looking at people. So you need training.
Right. Okay, thank you. Anybody else have a comment? Over there, Chad. No, no.
Good afternoon. My name is Godwin. Now, do you consider security of radioactive sources as part of the role of a radiation protection professional? I say yes. Because a small company that is involved in industrial radiography, the man is interested in making money. So he finds all way possible to acquire the source to carry out industrial radiography. He doesn't know about the effects and the people working in the environment. Now, like in my organization, we spelled out the conditions that you must have a radiation protection a supervisor who will be able to train, you know, the people carrying out this work in your facility. And for us to give a license to the professionals, we have to be able to look at if they are qualified to carry out this practice, you know, in this area of professionalism. So training is very, very important. If the professionals need to take this particular task.
Okay, thank you. Any other comments? Renat, okay, you're next.
Oh, hello, very quickly. Guys and Thomases again. I just think that the perfect amalgamation, really, of disciplines is radiation protection, definitely working in very close partnership with security, but also with professional eyes and knowledge from, as I say again, from the police, from the counterterrorism, because even though you have a fantastic security department who's very good at understanding the security risks on site, you do need expert help from counterterrorism advisors, because of they open your eyes to a whole new world, and more so. Giving you very specific advice on what is good practice and also the physical security standards that you need. So I think there's a three-way collaboration between radiation protection to understand what the risks are and what the most damaging sources are, between security and also, as I say, your local counterterrorism expert as well. So I think it's three-way.
Thank you. Renata.
Thank you very much. My name is Chavinsky. I'm working in the IEA, but I give a little bit of my own opinion on that question. I would like to answer first on the second question. Radiation protection professionals don't receive adequate education and training to perform their expected security role if they have a role in that area. So I'm coming at the moment, and then I'm coming to the first one. I see safety, the part radiation protection and security is an overlapping part. It should never be divided, because I think a radiation protection professional who works with radioactive sources has a responsibility also for the security part. And so with that opinion which I gave here, I think I answered on the first question. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. The last comment, then we have to move on.
Thank you. Rozlivka, Czech Republic. My opinion is that radiation protection professionals has a partly responsibility on the security of radioactive sources, because of they usually has full access to the sources and so on and so on. And from this point of view, it's necessary to have part of responsibility. Not full, I think, because full responsibility in big companies has to bear someone another. with specialists for security. But security is a part of the work of the radiation protection professionals. And for the second question, I think that radiation protection specialists don't receive adequate education and training to perform their expected role. If it is full, or it is only part of the security responsibility.
Thank you. I think we need to move on. And our next speaker will talk a bit about education. I don't think we need, he needs much introduction, although I may be the first person to introduce him by saying that he is the former president of the Society for Radiological Protection. With that, I'll let you take the stand.
Thank you very much,
Chris Englefield.
Thank you, Bernie. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My day job is with the UK's regulatory authority for, amongst other things, the keeping and use of radioactive sources. And in the UK, we have, since the 1st of January 2006, had a statutory regime for security in place. And really, just to annoy my Australian colleague who's sitting down there, I'll say I believe it's the most rigorous regime for the security of sources in the world. Australia think theirs is, but who knows? One of the reasons it's very rigorous is it applies from IEA Category 1 to Category 4, and for our own reasons, in a different way, legally, we have chosen to include Category 5 sources. Now, part of my work in the Environment Agency as a regulatory authority is to spend time with the University of Cumbria, and in that capacity, I'm speaking today. I'm not talking about the UK regime. So you see my title, and what I'm going to do is to give you, to be honest, initially a little bit of an advert about this university and this course, but to focus on the issues that we've found in developing additional training resources for the security of radioactive sources and indeed the security of other types of sites involving radioactivity. So my agenda today is the advert and to explain why the University of Cumbria is well placed to contribute to this issue and to describe it at a very high level and very briefly a new course which is shortly to be launched at the University of Cumbria, which is a master's degree in nuclear security management. I'll then briefly look at some of the issues that are being encountered and conclude and make an invitation to you. Here's the advert, bear with me. The University of Cumbria is a new UK university, only established in 2007, but before that it was a very long established educational establishment or a collection of establishments which have been joined together in this new form. Its campuses are in the northwest of England, very close to the English Lake District, and what we who live in Lancashire like to call God's own country, Lancashire itself. Sorry. thank you, Alan. The university already has, for other reasons, strong links to the UK nuclear industry, including what's known as the Energy Coast of West Cumbria and the Nuclear Decommissioning Authority. And it's been building its own capacity for a large range of courses across the subject spectrum in remote learning and has a unique facility for extensive simulation, which I haven't got time to talk about, but I assure you is extremely good and very relevant and will be developed for the course I'm going to tell you about. The university specialises predominantly in vocational training and has a very multidisciplinary background, which is why we in the regulatory authority saw it as an ideal situation for the development of the courses I'm going to describe. Now, one of those courses is an existing degree level qualification in radiation protection. Now, other degrees in radiation protection are available in the UK, and Godwin sitting over there will tell you about an excellent master's degree that he's involved with at another University, but this is an undergraduate degree, and it's designed, it's unique in the UK at that level. It's everything else is postgraduate in our country. And even before this MSc was conceived, it included a module out of 16 that are required to get the BSc on security. Indeed, it's a new degree, and the first cohort are just coming to the end of their first year. Now, one of the reasons that I believe the University of Cumbria can contribute to the provision of education and training for radiation protection professionals in security is the existence of its existing Bachelor of Science degree in radiation protection, which has been created over the last several years to meet a UK need for radiation protection specialists. The course, the radiation protection course, is modular, and each module involves a week in the classroom, 5 weeks of coursework, and an assessment at the end, and that happens 4 times a year. The university has a very well-developed network across the radiation protection profession, which it's been building over recent years, and it's strongly supported by the Society for Radiological Protection. In such a way, for example, that the course which is running in radiation protection has a tie-in to professional recognition, which is awarded through the mechanisms of the society. It also has links, largely through me, but not just me, to the regulators of radioactive sources in England and Wales. And it also has this strong vocational emphasis that this degree is designed primarily for people working in the industry, and it already uses remote learning methods, which I believe are suitable for overseas students, although we don't yet have any overseas students on that degree. But because of the existence of that degree, there is, at the university, a certain amount of underpinning knowledge which is relevant to this new degree, master's level in nuclear security management. And the syllabus for that degree is very strongly based on IAEA Nuclear Security Series 12, with the kind permission of the IEA. Thank you, Renata, and your colleagues for agreeing to that. It's entitled An Education Programme in Nuclear Security, and it provides in some detail a recommended syllabus for postgraduate education, and we're following that. It's important, perhaps particularly for UK colleagues, to understand that both in the context of the title of the degree and in the context of the IEA publication, the word nuclear means, in this context, all things radioactive and not just what in the UK is known as nuclear materials, nuclear licence sites. So the degree will address the security issues for nuclear sites, but also, and my area of interest, the security of radioactive sources, which is what I'm talking about today. And the idea is to provide an environment and a qualification which will enable staff already in the industry to develop an in-depth knowledge. It will include and draw on resources from already in the university and elsewhere, the radiological protection aspects, which are fairly basic compared to the degree, but drawing on those resources, security engineering, law, an appreciation of threat, some of the criminology and forensics issues, which is again part of the training already provided by the university, and management. And a certificate level qualification will be available as an option as well. The university has done some market research in this area and believes that this is something which could and should go forward because there is an underlying business need. Now, those of us who have been involved in this so far have encountered a number of issues, and I don't pretend to have answers for all of these, but I do think there would be value in sharing these issues with you. The first thing is, at least for me and for those of us who are involved, this is a new issue, a new area, and there are challenges in integrating new security components into education and training for radiation protection professionals. As far as I'm aware, I don't think this has been done in the UK before. The postgraduate training in radiation protection is very well established in the UK, but does not currently include anything relating to the statutory security regime required by the UK. It's also a problem because we would obviously be interested in attracting students to the master's degree from overseas, there are issues which we're still working on the security relating to the course and the fact that the course cannot work in classified, but either in classified facilities nor share classified information. That is an issue, but it's one that we are finding ways through. It's a sensitive area, but the university is progressing on the basis of using open source information and particularly in collaboration with industry, a high level of simulation, including the virtual environment, which is already very developed for other courses and will be adapted progressively for this degree. And part of that technology and remote learning underpins the ability of the University of Cumbria to deliver this course, we believe. So another issue is actually understanding the needs not only of the students and but also their employers, because obviously employers generally don't want to release staff for very long because it costs money. And so to spend a lot of time in the classroom is an expensive way of training people. And at the moment, frankly, the emphasis when we start will be on classroom time, but it will be increasingly migrated to remote learning so that it can be done more remotely, but with some optimised amount of time spent in the UK in the classroom at the University of Cumbria. Another issue we found is validation, a very familiar process for those who work in the academic field, but this is a new area, and so we're still working up processes and arrangements for ensuring that the quality of the material delivered and planned to be delivered is of a suitable standard for the award of a master's degree and delivers what employers would expect and students would expect. It's an issue still in a work in progress. Another one is cohort size. Although the university has done market research in this area, it's really difficult to define the likely interest. We don't think it's going to be huge. We could accommodate more, but the business plan for this relies on not much more than a handful of students per year. But we would sensibly plan on the basis of between 10 and 20 master's level students per year. It's likely to be a two-year part-time course, by the way. And one of the unique features, both of the, at least I think it's pretty unique, at this level of the bachelor's degree in radiation protection and this new degree, will be very extensive use of experts from outside. The university itself has a limited capability in this field, but it has extensive experience, particularly in its medical area, its ancillary medical degrees, supporting disciplines, of managing very large numbers of visiting staff, and that's the basis on which this degree is being put forward. So there will be invitations to WINS, for example, and certainly to the IEA and others to make a contribution to this, and the Regulatory Authority for Radioactive Sources. And I'm still negotiating this, but I'm hopeful for others in UK government to make a contribution as well. So in conclusion, we believe, and that's we, the university, as I'm representing them today, but also with the support of the regulator in England and Wales for the security of radioactive sources, that there is a need for a course like this. For a limited number of people, perhaps in the UK, we have a large nuclear industry. We also have a large number of premises, but as you've heard, the expertise in the UK for radioactive source security rests predominantly with the police advisors. So we're happy to share this course overseas with other people who have an interest, and I have explored this a little bit in Vienna with the IEA delegates at various meetings. There seems to be an interest. And there's an ability to build on the existing course and other courses at the university. But I have to say, Renata, thank goodness for Nuclear Security Series 12, because it saves a huge amount of time for any organisation that wants to move forward in this way. The work that's gone into that from the IEA has been extremely valuable. And of course, there's a growing library of material now, which wasn't there when we first conceived of this at the university, from WINS, and we will be drawing on that. So the reason I think that the IEA made this available is that there's a recognition of a need to build across the world capacity in this subject, and this is one way to do it. And an important part of that is by providing the technical knowledge to radiation protection professionals who already have a tradition of sustainable expertise in that field, that sustainability will be transferred to security. We hope the degree will be available from April next year. However, in all honesty, I think it's more likely to be October 2013. So there are the conclusions. I hope you found it of some use at least. And at the bottom, there's a request, an invitation for expressions of interest, both from contributors, but also anyone who has an interest in being or sending a student. And my academic email address is on the slide there. If you'd like to get in contact, I can send you information. And if you have a contribution to make, we'd certainly like to talk to you. But if you have students who would be interested, that would be useful information, and we'll put you in the information that the university puts out. So that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Are there any questions?
Hi, this is more of a comment and kind of support to your presentation, and I don't know if this is going to be brought up by any of the other speakers. But the IAEA is also, in the education realm, has started a network called INSEN, which is the International Nuclear Security Education Network. So for those of you in academia, if you're looking at building your capabilities in this area, INSEN is a excellent network, which focuses on developing materials, training faculty, and then also promotion of nuclear security. So. If anyone needs more information, I'd be happy to contribute, as I'm one of the subgroup chairs.
Bernie, may I respond? May I respond to that?
Okay.
Just very briefly, thank you for that. We are aware of that, but I, for one, have been a bit busy for the last 12 months and haven't yet, unfortunately, had the time to engage, but maybe we could talk at the end of the meeting.
I think if I could make a comment, too. We wanted Chris to talk about this, not as though it's the only thing out there, but as an example of the fact that education in security for radiation professionals is growing. This is not the only one. And besides that program of the IAEA, there's others that are going on in Eastern Europe. So use that as an example of the growing emphasis. Any other comments? Yes. Chad?
Thank you. My name is Olufemilayo. I'm from Nigeria. I want to find out about, in the presentation, you said something about having a BSc in radiation protection. Mm-hmm. And in the course module, there's a course on security. Does that mean that anybody coming in for the master's must have a BSc in radiation protection?
Certainly not a BSc in radiation protection, no, because the course is designed for a wide range of disciplines.
Okay.
I can't remember because I'm not a proper member of staff.
Because,
at the university.
The reason why I'm asking is in my university you have students with BSc in physics and they don't take any course on security.
No. But first of all, the module in the BSc is available or will be available as a separate product, so you can just buy the 1 week module. Because you have to pay.
Okay.
I can't give you the details of the entry requirements, but the people who are going through the degree at the moment do not have degree level qualifications, therefore that's fairly obvious. And for the master's degree, the university has rules, but I'm not in a position to quote them. But the ethic of the university, because it's vocationally based, is a lot of accreditation of prior learning. But I couldn't give you the details as I stand here at the moment.
Okay, thank you.
Paul Verhoeven, Netherlands. Could you please elaborate on the two questions which were asked before? Because one of the answers we've got here, and what do you think of the... first question, should this task be with an RPA or should this be a separate responsibility within companies, institutes?
Well, the approach we've taken in the UK, and we've had the regime in place for 6 years now, is it was clear right from the start that the best people we felt as regulators, if I put my regulator's hat on now, to take this forward in the UK were radiation protection professionals, because they understood right from the start the nature of the hazards. We didn't need to invest time in explaining that. They had a strong safety culture, and part of what we're trying to achieve in the statutory regime for security is a security culture. So our view, because it suits, we found, the profession as well as the regulators in the UK, it was good to use the radiation protection profession to do that, and we find that's a growing component now of professionalism in the UK for radiation protection professionals. And it's encased, in fact, in the syllabus for the competence of radioactive waste advisors, which is a requirement of the regulator. So it's built into that now. If you want a permission to hold radioactive substances in the UK, you have to have a radioactive waste advisor, and the syllabus for that level of competence includes security now.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks, Chris. We turn now to professional societies, and our next speaker is Eulenia Valdesco, who is the president of the Philippine Association of Radiation Protection. She was formerly chief of nuclear regulations in the Philippines, and is a consultant to the IAEA, WHO, and the Australian Nuclear Sciences and Technology Organization. Eulenia?
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much, Bernie. Good evening. I am pleased to share with you the experiences in the Philippines with regards to the possible role of a professional society in ensuring the safety and security of sources. Okay. Now, let me very briefly tell you something about the association. This is a professional society in radiation protection, the only one. And the mission objectives of the association, just like similar to other organizations, is to provide a forum to promote the science of radiation protection among concerned stakeholders and to undertake relevant activities to ensure that radiation safety regulation, among others, are understood, appreciated, and complied with by authorized users. Now, to achieve these objectives, the kind of activities that we do undertake, much effort has been given to the conduct of radiation safety officers training, such courses are designed to meet the regulatory requirements of the regulatory authority with regards to the designation of an RSO prior to authorization. The Philippine Association for Radiation Protection is the accredited training provider by the two regulatory bodies in the Philippines, one for X-ray and the other one for radioactive material. Now, the association has also organized and implemented workshop conferences for the continuing education of its members, and together with other relevant professional organizations such as the Philippine Organization of Medical Physicists, the Philippine Society of Nuclear Medicine, College of Radiology, non-destructive testing. We have organized various events to promote good radiation protection practices in the workplace. Now, we continue to maintain local, regional, and international cooperation. As an example, at the local level, we conducted a joint workshop with PNRI, Department of Health, and the DEPOMP for different courses that we undertake for specific groups of members. And then we continue to exchange information and experiences at the regional level, with the AOARP, which was established through IRPA. And then at the international level, when we do conduct national workshop in which international experts are required, then we do ask the assistance of the IAEA, the WHO, ANSTO, and WINST in the provision of resource speakers in these national conferences and workshops. Now, something about the regulatory infrastructure on source security, which is the heart of the discussion this evening, is when the Philippines adopted the IAEA Code of Conduct on the Safety and Security of Radioactive Sources and the additional guidance on export-import, then it was a commitment that the government undertook to develop national regulations and other measures to enhance the source security. And this, of course, led to the development of national regulations mandating the establishment of security measures for different categories of sources. Now, the emergent issues on this infrastructure, regulatory infrastructure development, is that in most cases, the radiation safety officers, because of the new security regulations in the country, the RSOs, in most cases, are designated as the responsible persons for source security. Of course, this is now relevant to the earlier discussion on whether they should be given this added responsibility. But the reality in my country is that no other person, probably, within the organization where radioactive materials are used can be better designated to undertake this task except the radiation safety officer. So whether they do have the required training, that is another story altogether. Now, the other issue that has emerged from that development is that both users and regulators have to go through a steep learning curve to ensure compliance with the security regulations. You know, regulators over the past 20 or 30 years, they are so used in enforcing safety requirements. And so the security regulations are entirely a new set of regime. And even the regulators require training on how to ensure compliance with the security regulation. So in the first 2 years, both the users and the regulators have to go through this learning curve. On the other hand, part of the requirement of the regulation is to have a security plan. And the security plan, of course, necessarily include a response when the alarm goes up. Then response forces have to act. And another issue that came about is that security officers, as well as response personnel, including enforcement agencies, the police, and related personnel, they are not adequately trained in radiation-related risk and in radiation protection. So there were some issues and there were some problems that arose from this. And we believe that the professional organization in radiation protection, of course, can have a role in integrating the safety and security-related issues. This can be done through the enhancement because it is already conducting, as a matter of routine, the training for RSO training. So in the beginning, we tried to enhance the training syllabus to highlight the need to secure radioactive sources and how best to achieve it. So when we introduced the concept of radiation protection, together with that, we also introduced what security is all about, and then talk about the different category of sources, the graded approach to security with regards to radioactive sources, threat assessment. So we try to introduce this at this stage. And then there is also a need to develop and implement a stepladder training for security officers because they cannot continue not to be involved in ensuring the security of these radioactive sources. But they are very they are very concerned about the risk of radiation, not having proper knowledge about how to protect themselves. So they cannot fully discharge their function as security officer. So there is a need to implement and develop and implement a stepladder safety training, starting from what radiation is all about, what are the effects and so on, and detection. Now, we need to organize, conduct source security awareness, and we started to do this for decision makers, because you know when a security program cannot be effectively implemented without support from top management, and because it requires resources, and so we need to convince the decision makers who understandably will have to provide the needed resources to implement it, that really, indeed, source security is important. So this is also to promote security culture in the organization. And then, of course, the organization, as it is now, having a good working relationship with the regulatory body in terms of being proactive in commenting whenever new regulations are being developed and formulated. We are part of the regulatory conference that say that give comments on the proposed regulation. This should continue, and of course, the enforcement of security as well as safety regulations among licensees is also promoted in this sense. Now, I put up this slide. This is my last slide, actually, on the membership profile of the organization, because, you know, a nuclear medicine society consists of nuclear medicine specialists. The non-destructive testing are NDT practitioners. But the Society for Radiation Protection draws membership from all sectors. So we have members from academe, industry, medical. So we have doctors, we have technicians, technologists, research, and we even have regulators as members. So we use this broad membership profile because I think this is a unique advantage in creating a forum in which discussion on security-related issue can be more open so that people can express their views and they can comment on regulations, on security regulations, if it is easy to comply with or impossible to comply with. So it creates an open discussion environment, and I think this should be explored. We even have graduate students as associate members. So thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
No.
If not, thank you very much.
Thank you. One, I would highlight what our colleague said, is the training of regulators in security. I think there's a big gap. You spoke at the beginning only on radiation protection, radiation protection professionals. Should they have the knowledge? I think it should start with the regulator. The regulator, if they license an activity, they should know what they do.
Good point. We're moving ahead. I think we're getting a little more sophisticated now. Our final speaker before the summary is Adam Korn, who's going to talk about some international aspects. Adam is a foreign affairs specialist with the National Nuclear Security Administration in Washington, and he's been working in this field for a few years. Adam?
Thank you, Bernie. Well, thanks a lot for staying so late. It's usually in my office after 6 o'clock. It's a ghost town, so I'm glad to see there's still a good turnout here. And I work for the Global Threat Reduction Initiative, which is an office in the National Nuclear Security Administration, which is a semi-autonomous agency under the U.S. Department of Energy. So a lot of people are confused about kind of where we fit in with the U.S. government, but that's pretty much where we're at. And again, my name is Adam Korn. Let's see here. So it's GTRI, the Global Threat Reduction Initiative. It's our mission to reduce and protect vulnerable nuclear and radiological material at civilian sites around the world. And it's important to note that our program is completely voluntary. Of course, overseas, completely voluntary, because every government's, you know, sovereign. But in the United States, it's also voluntary. It's voluntary at civilian sites. So when we approach civilian sites and talk about our security upgrades or our other programs, such as conversion and removal of excess nuclear radiological material, we let them know that it's their decision, but we do try to entice them and sometimes coerce them into really cooperating with us. So that is our mission, is to reduce and protect vulnerable nuclear and radiological material at civilian sites around the world. But we have three core goals to help us achieve this. So we have conversion programs where we convert HEU to LEU, which leads to permanent threat reduction, because obviously the less material there is out there, the less material the adversary can access to commit some sort of theft, sabotage, or attack. And then we have removal programs, and that's actually one of our most successful programs. When there's an orphan source or excess nuclear or radiological material, we've worked with foreign counterparts as well as domestically in the States to remove the material for permanent disposal and storage at times, and which also it leads to permanent threat reduction. Again, it's less material that's out there that an adversary can use for malicious purposes. And lastly, there's a program that I pretty much head in my office, which is protection programs. And protection programs is we protect high priority radiological and nuclear material from theft and sabotage. And we do this in a very unique way, and I'll get into it in a future slide of exactly how we go about these security enhancement programs. So as you can see from this slide, we have a very robust program, and we have a substantial budget and resources and allocations to achieve our mission. And we work with quite a few countries overseas, and we've been very successful in our security enhancements programs, our conversion programs, and our removal programs. And as of January 2012, we've secured, I guess, 861 buildings overseas. And in the U.S., we estimate we have roughly around 2,700 sites that are vulnerable and have high-risk sources or risk-significant sources. And so far, out of those 2,700, you know, we've only secured, we're a relatively young program, but we've only secured just under 400. But I guess our program has started about 4 or 5 years ago with this initiative. So we're actually, our average is pretty good, and as the years go on, it's our goal to have all of these sites secured domestically and make great headway in securing sites overseas that have risk-significant material. So I know I'm flowing along pretty fast. We're given 10 minutes per speaker, and I know it's not easy to have that restriction, but sorry if I'm speeding through these. So, you know, one of the challenges we had is there's a lot of isotopes out there that you know, that people can worry about in terms of, you know, if there is one use in an RDD, in a radiological dispersal device, or a device that sort of stands still and it's emitting this radiological, you know, threat. There's lots of isotopes we're concerned about, but we commissioned Sandia National Laboratory, which is in Albuquerque, New Mexico, to let us know what are the most, or what should be our priority, what isotopes are out there that should be our absolute priority in order for us to really define our program and define our initiatives. And they ran a down selection study, and they said they looked at materials that were used in very open facilities, and they looked at materials that also were used in very densely populated areas, and they decided that we should really focus on cesium-137 and cobalt-60 in the medical arena. And then in the industrial arena, the paper, the report that they wrote sort of instructed us to really focus on iridium-192 and americium-241, which, as you know, is used very commonly in the industrial arena. So we make sure our programs prioritize. We look at other isotopes as well, and everything's situational, but these are the top of our priorities. And you know, mostly what I've worked in is securing lots of these materials in hospitals. So you know, one of our main concerns is blood irradiators that use cesium-137, and we work very closely not only with the sites but also the manufacturers of these blood irradiators. And so we have certain types of security enhancements, which I'll go into in a future slide coming up here in a few minutes. But we not only try to retrofit these security enhancements around these irradiators in hospitals, but we also work with the manufacturers so when they actually construct the blood irradiator, we make sure that our security enhancements are already a part of their design. And so far it's been very successful because we have a very strong and good working relationship with the three manufacturers that make most of the irradiators in the US. So this is actually one of my most important slides. I know it's quite busy, but it talks about the threat environment. The threat environment is very important. It's because that is the main, that's really our motivator for our entire program. We like to protect, or we wish to protect radiologic material because, you know, through our intelligence analysis and working with law enforcement and Interpol, it has become definitely clear, even through open source information, that the terrorist, the adversary, is looking at these materials to create an RDD or some sort of device, and they're looking to steal this material so they can use it in some sort of attack. And they've chosen to be quite blatant about it, as well as surreptitious. So we're constantly examining and looking at that threat and really taking it quite seriously. We wish to be proactive and really making sure we're doing everything we can to minimize this threat. One of the main concerns we have when it comes to this threat is the insider. The insider is the individual who has legitimate access to this material, say someone in the hospital who has legitimate access, and the ultimate insider would be, say, an RSO, and they would use this access to steal the material or help other individuals steal the material so it can be used in theft, sabotage, and eventually maybe an attack. So we're very cognizant of this. And this is this particular threat is very critical to us because when we approach an RSO at a civilian site, we need to convince him to work with us in our program. So first we need to talk about, when we engage with an RSO, we talk about the threat. We talk about, you know, the adversary is looking at sites like yours. You have an unprotected site. And then we tell them about the risks involved. If an adversary does come in and steal this material, you know, it's a tremendous risk to, you know, your responsibilities to individuals in the hospital who have an open source. If the adversary is successful in cutting into the irradiator and exposing the source and bringing it out of the unit, not only getting a lethal dose himself, but everyone else involved. We talk about vulnerability. We often do a vulnerability assessment. And every single site is different. So the vulnerability assessment, it can be quite in-depth. It usually takes almost a full day to do a vulnerability assessment to talk about all the different ways an adversary would attack a site. And after we talk about the vulnerability of their particular site, which is something we've done just by walking around a hospital, after we meet with the RSO and we tell them how easy it was, often we see doors propped open with a rock or a brick or something like that, so that people have direct access to the radiator because people are sick of punching in the code for a cipher lock or something like that. Or we've seen people, or people walk in areas where they're unauthorized to walk into, and they're unchallenged. So sometimes we just see that by walking around. I've seen other instances where people they've had sort of very low-level security on a door, and I have some friends in law enforcement. They're used to all kinds of tricks, and they've opened these doors with a credit card, swiping it in a certain way and opening up the door that way and sort of bypassing the weak security system that exists. And we say this, when we explain this to the RSO, they're obviously quite shocked. But we need to tell them this information to help convince them to work with us. If they don't want to work with us, that's no problem. We have plenty of sites that are calling us to volunteer to work with us, not only domestically, but also overseas. So we have plenty in the queue, but we're always trying to expand our program and always try to schedule security enhancements. And I'll talk about exactly what our security enhancements are in my next slide. But, you know, I had a conversation today with an individual, and it was weird because the conversation was a lot like conversations I've had with RSOs back in the States. He said, you know, Adam, this program you're talking about, you know, it's going to be somewhat disruptive. You know, what's in it for me, for the RSO, to allow you, the federal government, to come in and install, you know, the security system?
I find that it's going to interfere with my operations. I'm afraid your security systems won't be very good. I'm worried about false alarms that are going to gunk up my system. And I'm also don't know exactly how long do I need to take my radiator offline to allow you to install these security systems. And I told him that, you know, our security system, that our security enhancements are very well thought out. These are common questions and common concerns he has. The truth matters, our security system would just take a day or two to install. In the meantime, he'd have to maybe work with another blood irradiator or another hospital that has a blood irradiator to compensate for the time it will be taken offline. So that's one of the workarounds that's been quite successful. And then he still didn't quite see it my way, which is not so uncommon. And I said, well, look at it this way. The adversary is looking for a soft target to steal radiological material. And what if he chooses, what if we approached you and you denied us the ability to work with you to secure your site? And several months later, the adversary chose your site because it's a soft target. He came in and he stole the material and then detonated either an in situ sabotage explosive to that radiological device, or he created an RDD with the device that came from your hospital. I mean, wouldn't you just have the moral responsibility at that point to, you know, to have worked with us? That would have been quite nice when the opportunity. I said, and also coming from a realistic perspective, you know, the media, if an attack like this happens, you know, people are going to look for heads on a platter, and they're going to say, where did this break down? Why did this RSO reject the help from the federal government after the federal government approached them? And I said, the media is going to turn on you, the victims are going to turn on you, and everyone's going to, you know, hold you somewhat responsible for the actions of the adversary. And he said, you know, Adam, that's absolutely not fair. And I just said, life isn't fair. And so he kind of got it at that point. But that's conversations I have with RSOs. And for the most part, RSOs in the States have been extremely welcoming of our program and really surprised to hear about the threat. And if they're not convinced by that, we have lots of videos of basically attack videos that we show them. We show a blood irradiator and at Sandia National Laboratory. And we had people with minimal training and a minimal equipment, or it's equipment they can buy at Home Depot, and we timed them, see how long it would take for them to cut into the irradiator to steal the source, and they did it in a matter of minutes. And that helped us with implement what kind of security program we needed to turn that minutes into an extended a lot more time to buy more delay, or make it at least difficult for the adversary to cut into a radiator to steal a source. So, okay, you got it. Two more minutes. I'll be real quick. This is the second to last slide. Okay, this is a very significant slide at the 2012 Nuclear Security Summit, theft of radiological material and radiological material kind of was on the agenda, came to the surface. You'll see that, you know, in the past, other types of threats have always been higher to the surface. People worried about nuclear threat, IND, improvised nuclear devices, or, you know, the other chem and bio, that always took priority and precedence. But we're starting to see slowly the international community is realizing the threat that the radiological material poses. And they're also taking note of the interest the adversary is taking in these radiological sources. So we implement our program through three different security enhancements. Through detection, delay, and response. When we approach a site and we start working with the site after our vulnerability assessment, we help them, and this is a program, when I say it's voluntary, we also pay for all of it. When I say we, I mean the federal government pays for all of it, so it's at no financial cost to the site. We enhance detection by implementing what we call an RMS, or remote monitoring system, which is cameras and eyes on and sensors on the irradiator, as well as pathways to the irradiator. We offer also delay systems, which is an IDD, in-device delay system, which wraps around, it's metal plates that wrap around the irradiator that makes it very difficult to cut into an irradiator. So it gives responders a lot more time to make a tactical decision of how to engage the adversary as he's trying to cut into the irradiator. And that brings us to response. We want to make sure that people responding, not only the RSO, but the on-site security officer and law enforcement, as well as special weapons and tactics officers, respond appropriately to an adversary who's trying to attack an irradiator, because his tactics will change. The adversary's tactics to steal the equipment will be, you know, very poignant, and the responders need to act in a much different way because the material is just too sensitive. It's something time is of the essence, and they have to engage a lot more aggressively and maybe be willing. So I'll finish up, I know. So So here's just a better idea of the security enhancements. We have our in-device delay system. That's just an example of the metal plates that screw into the radiator that hold the metal plates on that are very hard to cut through. We have motion sensors, data seals, magnetic balance switches that fits on the doors, iris readers for access control, area radiation detectors, and as well as personal radiation detectors that responders can wear to help them understand time distance shielding when they're engaging with an adversary. And this is a little information about our training program I just spoke of a minute ago, where we can work with law enforcement and security personnel and an RSO and send them for training in our Y-12 facility, which is in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, for a 3-day course, which teaches them that usually the first day is a very basic information about radiation safety, security, and the threat. And the other days are dedicated to tactics, and we do a lot of red teaming. Everyone gets a rubber gun, and we have a mock hospital, and we do force-on-force exercises, and we have half the team act as individuals who are trying to steal the source, and the other half the team try to protect the source. So it ends up being a very interesting play out, so you kind of can see where systems can fail and succeed. And we do this, we offer this internationally, so if you have individuals you feel would like to take this training free of cost, let us know. And it's something we can work with. So please approach me after this is over, and I'll be very willing and to speak with you about that. We've also have had this training overseas, where we send our trainers overseas to teach this course. So it's a great course. I've taken it myself. It's a lot of fun if you like to run around with a rubber gun. So my boss, Yana Iliopoulos, she was the one who was supposed to be presenting today, but she couldn't because of a family matter. But that's my boss's contact information. She's wonderful to work with, and you'll find her very cooperative with foreign counterparts. And that's my information down there. If you have any questions, please feel free to contact me. And thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Alex. Is there any questions? What question?
Jeroen Welbergen, Holland. Is it true that you also take responsibility of urban sources in countries that want to organize the Olympic Games?
Yes, we have.
Yeah, so you're the guys that send it to the WIP facility.
You send these
urban sources to the WIP facility.
Oh, yes, that's correct. And then, okay. But there's an individual who actually, she's in charge of that in my office, part of the OSRP program. And so she actually would be probably the best person to have all the details on that particular program. I'm more of a protection guy, okay. And she's the one focused just on removals. And I can give you her contact information if you want to get more details.
We'll not be needing it because we're not organizing the Olympics. But I assume UK didn't apply for this.
You got to look to the future.
I assume the UK didn't apply for this. They took care of their own urban sources.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Good evening, and thank you for your lectures. During your conversion process, you talked about conversion from highly enriched uranium to low enriched uranium.
Yes.
You did not specify the kind of facility you are referring to, if it is a research reactor or a nuclear power plant.
Yeah, research.
That's one. And if you are referring to a research reactor, have you considered the efficiency of the reactor after the conversion?
Yes to both questions. So research reactor, yes. We have been quite successful with that program with downblending, HU to LEU. And we found that we've done many studies, mostly, I guess, at PNNL as well as Sandia National Laboratory, about how would that affect the operation of the reactor, and we found that it's been proven that it didn't negatively affect the efficiency. So we've had a lot of success with the program. Otherwise, no one would ever work with us again. Yes, sir.
I see Department of Energy.
Yes.
I know there was a very open policy of putting all kinds of information on the international web pages. After 9/11, there was a stricter policy on that. And the discussion we're following at the moment is, in the Netherlands, we got a very open policy on sharing information with the public because of safety reasons. And people are allowed to to engage in when you request for a permit, they are engaged to comment on that. But for security reasons, of course, we want to protect our information. What's your opinion on that? How do you? What's your experience with protecting information on? You're talking about scenarios here. I can tell you a few scenarios, but first I want to know who you are before I tell you the scenarios.
Sure. I understand what you're saying. Well, I'll give you an example. After 9/11, we did some searches on the internet, and we realized that we went to the manufacturers of blood irradiators that were dealing with that housed a lot of cesium as the source. And we realized that, you know, we went to the manufacturer's website, and they wanted to give detailed specs of their machines to sort of show exactly, you know, how the machines are constructed and made and why they're superior over the competition in the market. And so all this information was out there. And then just for whatever weird reason, sometimes you find blueprints of the machine on other links and other websites that, you know, like someone who went to engineering school and they thought this irradiator was pretty cool and they did some digging around and they ended up putting it online or on their own personal web page. We took that deadly seriously after 9/11, and we did a lot of things in our power to take all that information off the internet. But we understand the adversary, you know, has done his own research, and like Afida Siddiqui, she sketched out some different types of RDDs and had her own thoughts and beliefs. She was at MIT about how to build a dirty bomb. And you know, a lot of people sort of freeze these things in time or print it out of this information. But we did everything we can to stop this and pull this off the internet. And so far, it's been pretty good. Every once in a while, it still pops up. It's one of those things. Someone finds something they printed out pre 9/11, and they still put it on the internet or put it on their website. Sometimes it's a manufacturer. Sometimes it's just an individual who's just sort of interested in this kind of stuff because the internet's attracts all kinds of people. But we do what we can to approach these individuals and take the information down and explain the sensitivity. Once we have this information, the U.S. government has its hands on it. We classify it as OUO, which means official use only. Which means that we have a lot more control over this information. So if anyone in the U.S. government, I guess, you know, leaks this information in a certain way, we have a lot more ability to quickly take it down, a lot more authority to quickly take it down, and we give people incentives not to share this information, or at least share it in a very controlled way. So I don't know if I've answered your question, but we've given a lot of thought to this information. We do our best to protect it best we can.
Okay. Thank you. I think security of information is a rather vast topic in which each country, I think, makes their own decisions on policies. If I could have the last slide. All I wanted to do was to summarize a little bit and not ask these questions. This was what we wanted to do, and I think in some way, if you can agree with me, we have touched on all of those. We certainly discussed what the role of the radiation protection professionals should play, and there seems to be a consensus that radiation protection professionals do have a role. They do need to be trained where they're not being trained. So we did talk about the second one. I think Chris talked a little bit about it, and we discussed the business about resources to assist the radiation protection professionals in competency and knowledge. Besides education, there's got to be a lot more training. And how do radiation protection professionals involve other stakeholders and traditional authorities? And you, Nina, talked a little bit about that. I think we've touched on all of that. And my conclusion, I think, is that this is our first incursion of security into this place. And I think the interest of you people, the comments that were made, says that security, I think, is finding a place here little by little. I was also encouraged by this is one of the few times we've talked about safety and security together, and there haven't been these arguments over which is more important and who is what. I think we're starting to mature. We're starting to see, without having that argument, that the two need to be integrated because it's integrated at the level of people working in facilities. And so I'm very encouraged by that. I hope we can come back again, if not us, other organizations, and there will be sessions on security and how that can be all integrated. With those comments, if anybody else has a comment, if not, I think we can call it a day because we're a little over budget. Okay, thank you very much for coming.